Welcome to the Story Night podcast, where you hear true stories on a theme, recorded live on stage and without notes. I'm your host, Jessica Holmes. This week we go back to August 2010 and the theme, Dog Days, Stories of Summer. You'll hear two stories that first take us into the Idaho backcountry, then take us by surprise. Featured storyteller Clay Morgan goes first. Clay wouldn't let me say this at the live event, but he is the director of the Story Initiative at Boise State University and one of the original founders of Story Night. His touch is on so many of the great aspects of this program. Thanks for everything you do, Clay, and thanks for this beautiful story about one fateful summer for a smoke jumper and the space program.
My story is about a lot of summers that feel like one summer to me, and it's about how those summers came to an end. And when I was a kid, winters were always the same here in Boise. It got cold, and I went to school. Every winter, it got cold, and I went to school. Summers, it got warm, and for a part of that time in the summer, I got to go up to my grandma's at McCall, and it was wonderful. She had a cabin built out of old, cold railroad ties, and we'd go up there, and we'd make forts, and we'd make rafts, and we'd get lost in the forest, and we just had this wonderful time. And I kept, and even then, really, really young, I was thinking, how can I make this go on forever, and how can I live here, and how can I make this my life? And sometimes, some days, we'd be down at the lake, and there'd be an old Ford tri-motor flying really slow on the other side of the lake, and it'd be dropping smoke jumpers down into the forest. They'd be making their practice jumps, and I thought, that's it. That's the summer that would just keep on going. And that's all I wanted to do. And I kept thinking about ways to doing it and getting jobs that would help me do it, and I didn't really get a chance to do it until I was in graduate school. And I was up in Missoula at the University of Montana, and I got the letter saying I was getting in. I could try out to be a smoke jumper, and I was just so happy, because that same spring, I was a fiction student up there, and I had gotten into Richard Hugo's poetry writing workshop, and he was the master. And I thought, oh man, I'm gonna be a smoke jumper, and I'm gonna be a poet. Yeah, I mean, that's it. That is it. And so he let me in, even though I was a fiction writer. And I got into a seminar room late the first day of class, and there were 12 students and Dick Hugo at the head of the table. And I was late, and there were only 12 chairs for the students. So I sat up on kind of a library table off the side of the seminar table, sat up there politely on the table, crossed my legs Indian style, and Dick Hugo started reading this long, long poem. And he kept reading, and he kept reading. And on that hard table, my feet went to sleep. Then my legs went to sleep. And then my butt went to sleep. And I was just waiting, and I was just buzzing from here down. And finally, Hugo finished this poem by a German poet, by the way. And he looks over his glasses like this for response. He wanted response. And I thought, well, here's my chance. I'll just slide off this table and shake my legs off. But I'd gone so far to sleep that when I slid off the table, my legs just buckled underneath me, and I felt this funny electric, you know, weird feeling coming up from my ankle. And so I was on the ground, and I was moaning and crying and trying to grab my ankle in poetry class, and a 200-pound poet named Quentin Duval thought I was having an epileptic seizure. And he jumped on top of me and tried to put his wallet in my mouth. And I was fighting him and fighting Quentin and everything and gurgling and all of that. And finally we stopped. You know, we almost got into a fist fight over it. And Dick Hugo just sits there very calmly and says, "That's the finest response to a poem I've ever seen." So I had this badly sprained ankle, and I showed up for training as a rookie smoke jumper, and I was out of shape because I couldn't train, but somehow I got through everything, and it was the greatest life you can imagine. Once you get through training, there's no routine. You never know what you're going to do. You may be in an airplane flying over New Mexico, down near the Mexican border, ready to jump on a fire, and the spotter will put his arm in front of you, tell you not to jump, and 6 hours later, you're flying to Alaska. No routine, no bosses, just this perfect summer job. And with the greatest experiences, not always related with fire, for example, June, like this last June, very wet and rainy up in McCall, and one day we were up at Squaw Meadows near Bergdorf, and we were building a sheep corral. And lunchtime came around, so we had lunch, and we were standing around, and it was rainy, and it's up about 6,000 feet, and there was this low ceiling, and it's just drizzling and miserable, and little ponds everywhere, little shallow ponds, and little green frogs, like tree frogs, everywhere. And one very, very kind and mellow smoke jumper picked up one of the frogs, and the guy's name was Steve Paulson. And he was talking to the frog. He's calling it Little Buddy. And he says, "Hey, Little Buddy, you know it's good weather for frogs." And he's talking to the frog. And he says, "Hey, Little Buddy, do you want some snus?" And we smoke jumpers didn't smoke cigarettes. We dipped snus, like Copenhagen. And so he took some of this used snus out of his lip and stuck it on the back of the frog. And through osmosis or something, it just went through that frog, and the frog went like that. And poor Steve was going, "Little buddy, little buddy." And I said, "Throw him in the puddle, throw him in the puddle." And so he throws him in the puddle, and this frog just floats to the bottom. And all of us smoke jumpers took our snus out of our lips, threw it down, waited about 30 seconds, and put new snus back into our lips. And another time up in Alaska, we would go up every summer to help out up in Alaska. Alaska's big, and we jumped this one fire that was in a blueberry bog. And the reason it was burning, it was a dry summer, and the top of the bog would burn, and the bottom of the bog was water. And you would cut down a spruce tree about 8 foot tall, and you would beat the fire out with a spruce tree until it caught on fire. Then you'd throw it into the fire and get yourself another spruce tree. But when we landed in our parachutes in this blueberry bog, it was windy, and it pulled us through the bog. And when we sat up, we had white Nomex big suits on. We were purple with blueberry. And also we were covered with bear shit. And there was bear sign everywhere. And I thought, "Oh, I get to see a grizzly today." And so at the end, we got the fire out, and everybody was going to bed. And the way what you do up there is you get the cargo parachutes, they drop the cargo to you, and you tie them up to a spruce tree, and you get in, and the mosquitoes will come in with you. But underneath this white nylon, the mosquitoes lose all navigation, and they just go to the nylon, and they stop flying. And you can kill them if you want, but after a while, you don't care, and you can sleep. But this night, I wanted to see a grizzly. And so I took one of our cardboard cargo boxes and set it up on a little rise, and I thought, "I'm going to set up all night if I have to see, you know, what's leaving all this crap out here." And so I was sitting there, you know, and watching and getting tired, and I fell asleep. And suddenly I heard this loud, loud noise, and it was just, bah, bah, and it was a mosquito in my ear against my eardrum, and it was just going, bah, 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 and I jumped up, and I was screaming, and I was jumping around, and the other jumpers were looking out of their little hooches at me. And I didn't know, it was just horrible. And I looked around, and I had a canteen there with lemonade mix in the water. And I turned my head over like this, and I poured my ear full of lemonade, and it went... And another time in a similar fire up there, we jumped this enormous fire that was just, I don't know, 100,000 acres, and we just fought the fire day after day, and it was gray sky, kind of undulating terrain, and it's light all the time. And I got a little tired of the guys I was working with, and I knew there was another camp of jumpers at the other side of the fire. So I thought, well, I'll go see them. So I take off walking, and I'm going up and down, and I look back, and I'm not sure where I was, and I go farther and farther, and I don't know where the sun is. Compasses don't work up there because you're right up, you know, magnetic north is like due west of you, and I went farther and farther until I realized I was lost. And it's in the middle of Alaska. You're in trouble. And I thought, well, just follow your nose. You'll find your way. And I get up on a little rise, and there I see this jumper's place. And it looked like a Bedouin encampment, these white little tents. And I thought, all right. And I walk to it, and I sit down at the fire, a nice little fire, and I look around. And I had built the tents for our camp back at the other side. And I remember thinking, oh, these tents aren't as good. And I get some of their coffee, and I'm drinking their coffee, and then I hear voices inside the tent, and it's my jumper buddies. And I had walked this three-hour-long trip all around. And just these amazing experiences. The other part of it, you know, it's a dangerous job. You work really hard. Things happen. People get hurt all the time. You learn good things. For example, if I want to get asleep some night and I can't sleep, I imagine that I am on a hillside about like this. The fire's burning, and I am sneaking off to grab 10 minutes of sleep, and that I dig myself a hole in the ground, get into it, curl up, and I'm asleep just like that. But things do go wrong, and you know, things started happening to go wrong with me. The first close call, we were jumping a fire on the middle fork of the Salmon River, and we were jumping out of a Beach 99, which is a really fast. It's a corporate plane. It's a really fast plane, very small, holds about 8 jumpers, I think. And you got to get out really fast because it's going so fast that if you wait a second, you're far away. And I was the second man, and I goofed up. I was awkward going out, and it slowed me down. And I got out over the middle fork of the Salmon River and had to, you know, turn with the wind and run as fast as I could back to our jump spot by the fire. And I get to where we're supposed to land, and I turn the parachute around, you know, the parachute has some forward speed that's supposed to slow you down, but it didn't do it much, and I kept going backwards, and I went over this snag patch of dead trees, this tall spires, no limbs, and I was looking over my shoulder, and suddenly, bam, I hit one of these snags, and I'm hanging up in this snag, and it's going creak, creak, and it's like a church spire, only skinnier. And I'm just going like this. I'm like, what do I do? What do I do? And my jumper, a buddy, my jump partner, had landed in the meadow, which was 20 feet away or so. And I say, well, what do I do? And he said, stay right there. I'll get my camera. And so, like a fool, I sit right there and let him take pictures of me. And then. I'm able to get my letdown line out and rappel down. And we go fight this fire, and it had been started by Boy Scouts by accident, and they were there. And so here we are helping them out. We're putting out the fire for them, and these Boy Scouts, though, kept coming by to stand and stare at me because I was the guy who had landed in this big tree. And And so that was really, really bad. Another time up in Alaska, if any of you heard in the last week, a former NASA administrator was in an accident up there with a pilot who had not been a bush pilot in Alaska, but was had been an airline pilot. Well, one time we were in this airplane, a Twin Beach with turboprops called a Vopar, and we had a Ween Air Alaska pilot, and that became Alaska Airlines, I think, later, who really hadn't jumpers before, or who hadn't flown this airplane much before. And we had been on a long patrol, and we're coming in to Galena Air Force Base, long, long runway. And we're coming in really fast, like you're supposed to. It goes forever. And I'm all suited up in myself. I got my reserve parachute, my backpack parachute. I'm right behind the pilot looking over his shoulder. And we hit the runway. We're going really fast, and then we start doing this. And we're going along, and I'm thinking, oh, this doesn't feel right. And we get over the side of the runway, and there are the landing lights, you know, the lights along the side of the runway. We start hitting them, and they're going like that. And we lose our landing gear, and we're on the belly of the plane. And we're just going, and there's sparks flying out the back. And we're going, and then something, we slow down enough, or something happens, but we turn, and Galena is on the Yukon River, right on the Yukon River, and we hit something that turns us, and we go out through the tundra and these little spruces, and the little spruces are coming at us and going boom, 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 right to the bank of the Yukon River where we hit the dike and go way up on our nose and way back. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking out the window, and the engine there catches on fire. And I look down past 6-7 jumpers, and the rookie jumper there can't open the door. And so I'm looking at the wing, and there's those little pop this out, and you can get out over the wing. But I look like the Pillsbury Doughboy. And I pop that out, and I squeeze out, roll over the wing, and everybody else gets out, but our plane is gone. And so we go to the NCO club there and get drunk. And thinking, we're fine, we don't have a plane, but the BLM sends another plane in, and the spotter comes in and gets us and makes us go jump. And I just felt like, this isn't good. But it was good. We did a good jump. And then, so these summers went on, and then I married a school teacher. The biggest adventure you can ever have. And the problem now was, I worked summers, she worked winters. And it just wasn't quite working out. And then she, Barbara, my wife, applied for the Teacher in Space program, and she got accepted. And she and Krista McAuliffe, you know, were going to be the teachers in space. And so while they were competing, if you can call it that, with the other teachers to see who got to go, I was jumping in McCall, and they were in Washington, D.C. and Houston going through all the tests and everything. And I'd be sitting on hillsides, and another jumper, Rick Hudson, would have a really cool 9-volt radio, and we'd listen to KBOI and hear, you know, how they were doing. And George H.W. Bush, the vice president, was going to announce who was going to be teacher in space soon. And we got a fire call in McCall, and it was in the Seven Devils. And Bob Shoemaker and I and others flew out there. It was a little fire. It was one tree, one snag, dead tree burning by itself on this knob of lava, you know, of basalt. And Bob and I jump, and I hit the ground so hard with my shoulder that it's just this, like I said, this electric feeling, and my arm isn't working too well. And we go to look at this tree, and it's starting, the fire is about 12 feet up, and it's called a school marm. It's a tree that goes up and then hook branches into two main spires, and these two spires were kind of like this. And we couldn't tell which way it wanted to lean, but the fire was burning right in the crook of those two spires. So we look at it, and Bob and I decide, Well, it wants to fall this way. And so we have an escape route, so if it falls funny, we're going to run this other way. And we figure out that's what we're going to do. And this was just outside the wilderness, so they jumped us. They dropped us a chainsaw, so that was cool. And so usually they drop us crosscut saws like this, and you got to saw the tree down that way. And so we're working on this tree, and we cut it, and we cut the wedge out, and it sits there, and we go back around, and we cut the back cut on it, and it sits there, and it's just sitting there. The tree is perfectly balanced. And as we cut into it, it's one of those old firs that has the rotten, empty heart. And so all the wind, the air is sucking in through our cuts and going and up, and it's just this fire. So we're making it worse. And so we've got wedges, these wooden wedges about like this. And I take one of the wedges, and I put it in the back cut, and I go thock, thock, trying to get it to come over, thock, and we hear this crack above us. And we look up, and the thing's starting to do this. And Bob and I turn, and we run out our escape route. And I'm running, and we're running away from the sun, and so the shadow of the tree is in front of us, and it looks like that shadow of the chicken hawk coming down for the chicken. And I'm running, and it just goes, whoa, and it just squashes us. And I wake up, and my jaw is over here, and there's a stob, you know, a stick of, I had been knocked down on a buckskin log on the ground, and a stob was up right in here and into my mouth, and I couldn't breathe. And Bob was about 8 feet in front of me, and he was turning around looking at me, and he had the worst expression on his face I've ever seen. And I was just my lungs just weren't working. And my heartbeat, I could see it in my vision. And then all of a sudden my lungs worked, and I breathed, and everything came back. And all the colors of all those beautiful wildflowers just kind of went ultraviolet all around. And I was okay. And I had cracked several ribs and dislocated my jaw and everything. But the good thing was I was off the jump list. And I was in back in McCall, and I was packing parachutes rather than jumping, and it was when they announced the teacher in space, and it was Kristen McAuliffe, and Barbara was her backup, and Kristen and Barb went down to Houston right away to start training for the Challenger space shuttle flight, and I went down. A few months later, after a few more jumps, to join her. And that was the end of my jumping career and those endless summers that I had going. Thank you.
Story slammer Nathaniel Hoffman is next, with a tale about a series of comical misperceptions in and about the backwoods of Idaho.
I didn't think I was going to get picked. This is my first time here. And so I didn't shave, and I'm about to tell you guys a story about my first summer in Idaho going down to the Salmon River, but it involves me looking like an FBI agent, and I don't really look like an FBI agent right now. So I grew up on the East Coast in Baltimore, and I went to college in upstate New York, and after my freshman year, I'd never been out west before, these two hippies came towards the end of the year to our campus, and one of them had a guitar. I think he's coming to town. Is Dave Rovix coming to town? The Earth First singer? I think he might be. The other one had a record, and a criminal record. And they had an amazing slideshow of the Frank Church Wilderness, which I had never seen before. Salmon River, big trees. And then, you know, the fifth slide in, these big trees cut in half, and like the giant, you know, log that's bigger than the man, bigger than the hippie. And I kind of listened, I took notes, I sat in the back, I was involved with like the environmental club or something, and I wrote down Dixie, Idaho. They're like, yeah, it's kind of near Dixie, Idaho. Has anybody been to Dixie, Idaho? A couple people, okay. So I had this little green notebook, like a little teeny, you know, one that fits in your breast pocket. I wish I had one right now. And I got on a bus at the end of the... I just called my mom and said, I'm going to go out west this summer. I got on a bus in Ithaca, New York, and got off a bus in Missoula, Montana. And I had a highway map of the west and a backpack and a sleeping bag. And I stuck my thumb out, and I headed to Dixie, Idaho. Not, I mean, most of you don't know where Dixie, Idaho is, but... I mean, we all live in Idaho, so we know sometimes roads end, right? And you're, for a hitchhiker, that's not a great situation when the road ends. So I get to Grangeville, Idaho, from Missoula, and I see a rafting company. I'm like, oh, there's got to be hippies at a rafting company. So I go, I got my backpack, and, you know, I'm clean shaven, Ivy League boy with, like, big backpack, brand new backpack. And I'm like, hey, I'm trying to get to Dixie. And the very nice young lady who runs the rafting company, she's like, why do you want to go there? And I knew to be a little cautious, but she seemed nice. This is like an outdoor pursuit rafting, right? So I said, well, I'm going to find the Earth First camp. And that was not the right thing to say. She turned red, and she said, why the hell would you want to do that? And this young woman who, you know, maybe could have been my peer at college, gave me a lecture about the logging industry, Idaho. This is my introduction to Idaho. And I kind of got, I weaseled my way out of it. I said, thank you. She didn't tell me where Dixie was, by the way. I looked closer at my map, and I saw Elk City, which is quite a bigger town than Dixie. This guy knows what I'm talking about. Elk City, I don't remember the mileage, but it's at least like 30 miles on a dirt road, perhaps, from Grangeville, maybe more. So I'm sitting there in a ditch on a dirt road with my thumb out. Nobody's driving by. Eventually, some people come by, and they're like, where are you going, you know? I'm like, just going to Elk City, you know, just doing some backpacking. It took me a long time, and I walked probably 15 miles, but I eventually got to Dixie, and I don't see any Earth Firsters around Dixie. I did see a sign. There's a landing strip in Dixie, and there's a cafe. I assume it's still there. I'm going to go back soon, but the sign on the cafe said, no Earth Firsters allowed. somewhat like the laundromat in wherever your husband was. But at this point, I guess I realized that there was sort of a game going on here. So I was just a college boy out backpacking in Idaho from Baltimore. Again, you know, I didn't have the camo hat. I had a grilled cheese sandwich, and I'm sitting there in this cafe. I was a vegetarian too, by the way, at the time. Sitting in this cafe, and a bunch of old guys come in, and sit down next to me, and they're like, you heard about the Earth Firsters? I'm eating my sandwich, and the guy's like, no, where are they at? And he's like, oh, you know, 20 miles up the road, you see another road. He gives them directions, and I take my little green book out, and I'm writing down. I eat my sandwich, I'm very sly, close up my book, go outside, and then a guy in a VW, an old guy in a VW bus with, like, he had reupholstered the inside of the VW bus with some leopard skin. He comes by, and he's been there 1,000 times. He's going down to the Salmon River. I don't tell him what I'm up to. I tell him I'm backpacking. He gives me this awesome tour. We go down to the river. We drive all around. And then I basically tell him what I'm up to. And he drops me off on the road. I got to finish up, Darren. Anyway, the point is, I get there, and they think I'm an FBI agent. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Story Story Night is brought to you by founding partners the Boise State Story Initiative and The Cabin, venue partner The Linen Building, design partner Neighborhood All-Stars, and importantly, our broadcast partner, Boise State Public Radio, who makes this podcast possible. Please donate now at radio.boisestate.edu. Our Story Story Night theme is by Dan Costello. Hear more at hearcostello.com. Please join us next week for a teaser of our September 27th event, White Lies, Stories of Polite Fictions. Learn more at storystorynight.org.